Welcome, Capital Raisers. On today's show, Tim Mai comes on and talks shop with me about breaking through the limiting beliefs that keep us from making the jump into syndication. Tim created a teen millionaire challenge with Javier Hinojo and facilitated teenagers making offers on multi-million dollar 100 plus unit properties. We go into it and raising capital on this show. If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show episode 248, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Tim Mai on the Capital Raiser Show. What's up, brother? How you doing, man?
Oh, what's up? What's up? Hey, Ruben. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my God. I laugh every single time. I can't even figure out why. This is such a blast, man. I love being a podcast host. Welcome to the show, man. Capital Raiser Show Season 3 now brought to you by PitchDecks.com. My partner, Richard C. Wilson's company. I had him on the show. And you have had him and a bunch of other people like Corey Peterson on your event that you do every Tuesday. Before we go down that road, man, tell me a little bit about your background, man. How did you get into this thing called real estate investing, syndication, and capital raising?
I was originally from Vietnam. I came to the US with my older brother. I was 12 years old. He was 19. Two boys on the street. We hustle and survive. You know, after college, I got a good job at an IT company doing network management software consulting. You know, fresh out of college, they were paying me $40,000 a year, which is about $20 an hour. And they were charging $230 an hour for my time as a consultant. Is that crazy?
Okay, we have to talk about that because I definitely can relate with that. But yeah. Anyways,
yeah. When I had that job, I thought I had it made. This was during the dot-com boom. And of course, the dot-com bust came right after that. And the company went belly up. So I was forced to decide, what am I going to do next? And I started reading and researching. And one of the things I found out was that over 80% of self-made millionaires invest in real estate. And I was like, well, if that's what self-made millionaires do, and I want to be a self-made millionaire, then I'll do that. So I got started in real estate investing in the single family home space, wholesaling, flipping. This was 20 years ago, 2002. Yeah, so that's kind of how I get my start.
Okay, so I was in a bank at Wells Fargo, and I probably made between $40,000 and $80,000, depending on my commissions, for doing all kinds of loan products. I was in the Spanish department. We did Texas loans. We did home mortgages, refinances, no doc loans, et cetera, et cetera. And if you think about a mortgage, let's just say that you have a $100,000 loan over 30 years, you end up paying like probably much closer to $260,000. So essentially, the bank would make over 30 years $160,000 on every single loan that I did. They were paying me about 40 grand, 40 to 60 grand, actually. I was probably averaging around 60. And they always wanted to restructure my commissions. They always were trying to figure out how they could leverage me to suck more juice out of me without paying me any more, or in fact, pay me less if possible. And I hated this. Not golden handcuffs, but the corporate America lifestyle, the being in the rat race, earning just enough money to keep you there, but not anything more than that. I couldn't do it anymore, dude. So one day I quit. So I can definitely relate, man. So you said you were from Vietnam, and then your childhood. So are you first generation or second generation?
First generation immigrants. Yeah,
I'm first generation too. I'm one of the first in my family born in the United States.
Oh, wow.
So this is very cool, man. I'd love to talk about this kind of stuff. What was it like for you growing up trying to integrate yourself into this society, not just as an American citizen, but as a person? Did you know at a young age that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So growing up in Vietnam, Vietnam culture in general is very entrepreneur, very hustle
really?
Life. Growing up in my area, especially, like a lot of houses, they have sort of business from like at home. My dad shared with us a story about how the most he ever worked for someone else was 3 hours. And he said he quit because he found out that they dictate how much he's going to make. So growing up, he's always like pounding in our head that you got to be your own boss, got to have your own business. I think that kind of stuck with me. So I have 7 siblings, including myself, and all of us have our own business.
Really?
Right? It must have stuck for all of us.
That is fascinating. So in Mexico, it's like that too. Like if you live in a little, what we call fraccionamiento, which is essentially like a neighborhood built of identical houses, a lot mm-hmm. of them will have businesses running out of their houses right in the neighborhood. It's like you don't even have to leave the neighborhood and go to Circle K. You could just go to your neighbor's house and buy whatever you want. I mean,
exactly.
Sometimes they even have alcohol there.
Yeah, no doubt. In Vietnam, when I was growing up, I don't think there was an age limit on how young, because I had my dad used to drink beer a lot and we would have to take turns to go buy him beer. So as a kid, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old, I couldn't buy beer.
Dude, I swear I did the same thing in Tuxpan, Nayarit, Mexico. They sent me to go buy cigarettes and beer and I was like 6 years old.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff, dude. This is so fun.
Yeah.
All right, man. You have 20 years of real estate experience. Tell me about this journey that you've been on, and at what point did the light switch flip and drive you towards the capital raising and syndication side of things?
So I've been in the real estate space, like a single family home, especially for most of those 20 years. It wasn't until COVID that I switched. During COVID, dealing with evictions, dealing with permitting on our flips was just like too much headaches. That's when I decided to completely cut off the single family and focus more on the land side of things. So we do a lot of land acquisition, land entitlement. I'm trying to get into land development as well, as you know, doing BTR communities. I've had a lot of friends throughout the years that have gotten into multifamily, commercial real estate. Every time I watch them, they go into business, they do well. In my head, I'm like, man, I want to do that, but I don't think I can do it. The numbers are just too big. The deal seems more complicated. So for the longest time, dude, I have this limiting belief that I can't do multifamily commercial real estate.
Hold on, dude. Let's break this down. What was the limiting belief? Have you explored this? Are you pretty self-aware of what that belief was? Did you have a coach help you break that?
No, I mean, it's just the belief that like, it's just over my head. Like, it's just more than I like part of it. I tell myself, I was like, I like simple business. I like business that I can do in my sleep, which I was able to do that with a single family home space. I like a business that I don't even have to hire very intelligent people to do the work. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, I tell myself that I just want simple businesses that anybody can do. It's like a McDonald's, right? Like a kid can go in and do my business. I taught my, at the time he was 16 years old, I taught him how to flip land and he did his first deal like that, you know?
Your 16-year-old son flipped land? Did you say that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, no way. That's yeah. absurd. Okay.
Yeah. He's 18 now, but that's the thing. Like, that's what I love about the single family home business, the land business, is that it's very simple. I can teach anybody to do. And so for the longest time, I keep on telling myself, it's like, okay, this single family home business is very simple. I know how to do it. I can do it in my sleep. This multifamily commercial real estate is much more complicated, much bigger numbers.
Not to mention, you're not going to be able to do it by yourself. You're going to have to take on partners.
Right, exactly. And it wasn't until, so check this out. I met a guy. I did an event that Robert G. Allen, for those of you guys might have heard of him. He's like the godfather of no money down real estate. He wrote his first book, old school. He wrote his first book in 1980. And I'm actually here in Utah right now, his hometown, because I'm doing a workshop with him this weekend. And so we became great friends. But anyways, so I did this event and I had Robert Allen to come out to speak as a keynote speaker at the event. And one of the guys that I met there at the event, attendees, in talking with him, so he's in multifamily commercial, and he shared how he got started in the business was only 2 years prior to that. He was a fix and flip guy, so similar to what I was doing. And he said, Tim, these days, each deal that I do add at least $1 million to my net worth. I was like, what?
Wow.
I was like, damn, that's badass, right? So like he's, and I actually interview him, Javier Hinojo. I interview him on my show as well.
What's up, Javier?
Yes. When talking with him, I was like, man, this guy is not much smarter than me. He's not any more capable than me.
He's smarter than he, actually, he's like my mom. He reminds me of my mom in the sense that he's way smarter than he projects himself to be.
Yeah. He has that persona that it's like he's a normal guy. So it had me feel like if this guy can do it, I can do it. And then my son, who was 16 at the time, I wanted to nudge him into this real estate investing space. So I was talking to Robert Allen, saying, hey, because when I first got started, he wrote a book called The 1 Minute Millionaire with Mark Victor Hansen. And I was a part of that program. So my name is in the back of that book.
Really?
I told Robert, I was like, hey, let's do a book together. I'd love to do a book with you. Maybe we'll do one called The 1 Minute Millionaire for Teens. Well, he said, well, I can't use it, that brand. But so I was like, okay, how about we'll do one called the Teen Millionaire Challenge. And I'll recruit Javier and we'll have him teach the teens syndication, multifamily. And then Javier also has a 16-year-old daughter. So it's just perfect. We both have kids. So we launched this program. We kicked it off as a 2-week summer camp style. We took on 19 teens ages 16 to 20 years old. And we spent 2 weeks in Javier's office to teach him commercial real estate. And just watching these teens, I mean, like as young as they are, to get on the phone, making offers to brokers on like $50 million deals, $100 million deals, like, because we were going after 100 unit plus deals. So they're all big deals. And I'm like, wow, like these teens do it so naturally. And as a result of the program, the teens made offers on well over $2 billion worth of real estate. So working through that whole Teen Millionaire Challenge program helped me further, I guess, believe in myself that I can do it.
That's so amazing. I love that story. Oh my God, what a fascinating study and challenge for, man, I wish somebody had put me through that challenge ages and ages ago and got my head right.
Yeah, man, me too.
I didn't get into real estate until I was like 35 or 36, man. I should have started at 16.
No kidding. We all wish we could do that. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So yeah, I'm actually relaunching. We got through our first year. Now we're relaunching that program as an online weekly Zoom training plus deal making. My vision for that is because in raising, I have two boys, 15 and 18. In teaching them entrepreneurship, I realized that there's a gap, there's a missing in the industry. There's not an easy way for young people to be able to partner up with adults and expedite their entrepreneurship journey and learn. So I was like, okay, you know what I want to do? I want to create an ecosystem where on one hand, we teach young people to source deals and underwrite deals. On the other hand, we teach adults passive investing. And then we, the syndicator, operator, put all the pieces together, and now the young people get to be co-GP in these deals with us. I actually recently just opened up for applications for this year's program, teenmillionairechallenge.com.
What does it cost, dude? I should put one of my cousins in that program.
It doesn't cost anything for the teen. So, and we define teens as under 21 years of age.
Yeah, I know somebody like that.
So it doesn't cost anything for the teens. They do have to apply. And so they have to want it. Like if the parents tell them to do it, that, you know, it won't work. We won't let them in.
That's where I'm going to struggle because I want to force these cousins of mine to go and they don't care about it whatsoever. Let's go back about your kids, 15 and 18, two boys. You're talking to them about investing. I've asked this question numerous times on the show. Hey, are you planting any seeds with your kids about being entrepreneurs and getting them to like manage the legacy wealth that you have been creating? And most of the time, the answer is like, nah, like they could do whatever they want to and they're not interested in real estate. For you, are you experiencing that your kids actually, so we were just talking about forcing people into this kind of path. Do you feel like you're doing that? Or do you think that they're like willingly and interestingly wanting to go down this path? Tell me more about this.
Yeah, definitely. I can't force them. I mean, they're teens. You can't force a teen to do anything. However, I've known all along that I want to nudge them into the entrepreneurship. So at a very young age, they had lemonade stands. When they were in Boy Scouts, we did a lot of door knockings. Even when they wanted to go see a concert, we would have them bake cupcakes and go door knocking, selling cupcakes to raise money for the concerts that they... And I didn't always did this. So my first son, my first boy that we had, oh my gosh, we shower him with everything he could possibly want. And then one day I just look at the house, I'm like, we live in this, it was like over 4,000 square feet house. We had, I think it was 5 bedrooms or something like that. And we, all 4 of us, live in the massive bedroom, and the all the other rooms are like toys everywhere. I'm like, I don't want this. This is not my vision of what I want for my kids. And so, yeah, so since then I decided, okay, that's it. We're not buying them anything other than necessities, obviously food and clothes, and provide them with a home. But any toys that they want, any games that they want, they're going to have to find a way to earn money, whether it's doing chores, whether it's door knocking, whether it's selling stuff. My older son, he loves tinkering with stuff. So he used to buy Nerf guns, mod it, and then sell it on eBay. I have them learn to earn their own money to buy their own stuff that they want. And so I think that entrepreneurship, even if they decide, like my younger one, my 15-year-old, he loves gaming. So I can totally see him growing up to either be a pro gamer or a game developer. But he knows the entrepreneurship way because, I mean, he kind of grew up with that. Who knows? He might have a gaming company, business. So yeah, I do nudge him a lot, but can't force him for sure. Not at this age.
Fascinating. So this culture that you experienced as a kid is still happening within your family, where your kids are getting some of that entrepreneurial culture that comes from Vietnam today. And like, for the Americans that are listening out there that do not have this culture within their family, it's kind of an interesting case study. Not that we're analyzing you too crazy, but this is so cool, man. Like, I wish more people realized how lucky they have it here in the United States, and how much opportunity they have to become an entrepreneur. Because most people are like, they have blinders on and they're just going through life, repeating this process of waking up, going to work, going to bed, and repeating the process with no way to create financial and create generational wealth for themselves or their families, because that's not even something that's on the radar for them. So I think for people like you and I, we have a lot of fun with this moral imperative to share with the world that there are ways to create generational wealth. And, you know, for me, that vehicle is capital raising and real estate syndication. So this is a lot of fun. Tell me more about your business, though. So we were kind of chatting a little bit before we got derailed on numerous topics about you making this transformation of going from single family real estate to commercial real estate. Where was that trigger point for you?
Yeah, so like I said, that trigger point started April 2021. Where it's like, okay, I want to do this. But I actually didn't officially start until April 2022.
But that was then, like 5 months ago. Crazy. Six months ago.
And then like even my weekly virtual meetup capital raising party.
That is an amazing party, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. That only started in July of this year. So 4 months ago. So in terms of coming into the commercial real estate space, I thought a lot about what role I want to play within the space. How do I want to position myself? Because I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. And now that I'm older too, I'm more selective, I guess, in terms of what I want to do moving forward. I thought through a lot about that. And I've also asked Javier too. I was like, hey, if you can start it all over again, what part of the business would you focus in on? And he said, I would just raise capital. Because he sourced a lot of deals, or used to anyways. But these days,
why for you? Why raising capital? I mean, obviously, Javier said to do so. But from your perspective, from my perspective, I think multifamily is a two-part business. There's the acquisitions and acquiring of real estate, And then there is the acquisitions and acquiring of capital. They're two distinct businesses. And I was always of the mindset of, if I can master the capital raising, my services will always be in demand because there's such a need for this. There's no education around the topic. So I commend you for doing your capital raising party and all this, even your capital raising summit that you got coming up. So we'll be talking about that here in a minute. But from your perspective, what do you love about the capital raising side? Why were you driven to it specifically?
Because I did a lot of fix and flip in a single family homes. I raised a ton of money. I mean, I've raised in the tens of millions for all the deals I've done. And so I'm not new to capital raising from that perspective. I'm new to syndications, but raising capital like as private lender, debt-based capital, not equity-based capital. I've raised plenty of those. So I was like, okay, I already have this skill set of raising capital. And what I like about raising capital that's different from sourcing deals is a lot more scalable because the relationship is all repeatable. And that's the thing I love. When you're dealing with a seller, chances are you're just going to buy a property from that seller once, twice. They have a lot of properties a few more times. But generally speaking, for the most part, it's probably once. However, a relationship with a passive investor, on the other hand, they can invest with you once, twice, five times, 10 times, like as much as you turn their money over. And it's also easy for them to refer you their friends and family to invest with you as well. So that relationship, the relationship is a lot more leverageable, a lot more scalable. So I look at these days, when I look at business, I look at businesses from the perspective of relationships. When I establish a relationship with someone, how long can that last? How many times can I do business with that person? How scalable is that? So I look at things from that perspective. Same reason why I'm doing the meetups that I'm doing, the interviews, the live events that I'm doing. It's all to build those relationships, especially like expediting my relationship building process and have that be a repeatable process and a repeatable in terms of transactions that I do with the relationships that I build.
All right. So I'm going to extract you and have you look through a lens at my early capital raising days. We used to raise capital from joint venture partners. We would create an LLC. They would bring 100% of the money and we would do 100% of the operations. They had to do a couple of things, including some management, deciding when the property was sold, what we were going to do, you know, because they have to be JVs, not just on the money side, or else they would be passive. Although this is more apparent in the syndication game than it was for me back in those days. But here's what I realized, man, is like when I got back into real estate, because I did leave for a while for multiple years, went back to corporate America. And when I came back, I found out about this thing called syndication. But the way to raise capital for syndication, I didn't know if it was the same as raising from joint ventures. I knew that I had the skill set to bring money partners, but now these guys are passive and they have different requirements. They want very high levels of communication and an investor experience, a passive experience where they're not putting in baseboards or dealing with toilets, tenants, or termites or any of that stuff. They're completely hands off, but you don't raise capital the way you do for them or even from single families, because a lot of times when you're taking down these smaller properties, you tell people, hey, this is what we're going to buy it for. This is what we're going to do to the property. And this is what we're going to sell it for. And that's it. There's no other major communication. You're not telling people what is the occupancy rate and how many units have been rebuilt or reconstructed or refurbished and all these other things and updates. And when do you get your K-1s? And we're doing the cost seg study and this is what you're going to get. And it's way more moving pieces than a small property. Have you experienced a radical shift or not about raising capital the way that you have been doing it versus raising capital for syndication?
Not really. I think that the major difference is just the type of people you're going after. And then also to the, you're educating them differently. And even the single family homes, I've never, well, not never, but seldom do I do partnerships or joint ventures. They're debt-based capital. And so it's always been very passive for my investors. So it's a very similar. So the only difference between what I used to pay them before versus now is it's almost like they get a preferred return and that's it. With the single family side, they'll get a 10%, 12% preferred return and that's it. There's no, they don't get any of the upside. So the way that I am now transitioned to educate my investors, like, hey, not only do you get a preferred return on the front end, you also get an upside on the back end. So it's actually much better than what I normally pay you before. So now, of course, there are people that they like the short term of the residential single family home stuff. They could be in and out a lot sooner and they can be more liquid that way. So for those people, then yeah, it's just they're not a fit. But for the ones that like to have the money out working longer, so that way they don't have to keep on churning this money and there's no break in between where the money goes to work for 6 months and then there's 2 months before we put it to work on another deal. This way the money can stay out more consistently. And then also too, I'm attracting very different people too now. I'm attracting people who they know syndications. They invest in other deals before. So now with those people, there's less education that's needed. They already understand how the business works. So I don't really have to sell them so much. And so I am making a more intentional focus on those people. And also, you know, the people, even if they don't have experience, but I come in and tell them ahead of time that, hey, these type of investment is a longer term play. It's a lot more passive. I don't think the person is really the same person. I think it has a lot to do with how we frame the business relationship with them. That is the main difference.
Fantastic. Very cool stuff. All right, man, let's jump into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what is the best vacation you've ever taken?
I love Europe. So after I got laid off from my IT job, I wanted to take a break, take my parents to Europe. And so she's my wife now, but at that time she was just my girlfriend. Took my mom and dad. We went to France, we went to Italy, we went to Switzerland. Like, you know how Europe, have you ever been there?
I've been, yes.
Okay, yeah, the transportation is phenomenal.
It's a totally different than the United States.
So we would sleep on the train at nighttime and then we'd go explore stuff during the day. So yeah, that's the best.
Yeah, do those train rides going through the country, like through Slovenia, you're just like in the moons out there and you're drinking some wine, looking out the train, wind blowing in your face. Why can't we experience something like that here in the United States? It's not quite as common. Anyways, favorite book of any kind?
Rich Dad, Poor Dad book always comes to mind. I bet a lot of entrepreneurs read that and know of that book. And so, yeah, that book just further implants for me the entrepreneurship and real estate, even though it's not a real estate book, but he talks a lot about real estate in that book as well. So yeah.
It's absolutely a breakthrough book for most people. Tell me the craziest thing that you have seen during your travels.
We've traveled a lot of places, especially Asia. And when we go to an Asian country where there's a lot of poor people, it's not really crazy, but it touches my heart differently. It's like, wow, I'm so privileged. Mm-hmm. It makes me want to make a bigger difference for humanity.
Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
Being laid off was a big one, right? And then, like I said, you know, talking with Javier and him saying that he adds $1 million net worth per deal, that was another like life-changing moment.
Best way to raise capital from your perspective, short answer on this.
I would just say education. That's why I'm doing the weekly virtual meetup and interviewing people and doing the live events is to educate people because it's instant credibility, instant authority.
Do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
Know that you're going to have them no matter what. Like we all do. Just know that you're going to have them. Find someone who already got through it or someone who's doing what you want to do and go talk to them.
Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
I'm not sure, but it does help calm me a lot in terms of troubles, in terms of challenges, in terms of anxiety. Like for me, I was like, you know what? I trust God is going to handle this. Mm. I do my part. God's going to do his part.
And, you can't get any more spiritual than that, brother. Come on. All right. So what do you love about owning lovebirds, Indian ringneck, and other kinds of parakeets?
I love animals in general, and I go through different phases of my hobbies when it comes to animals, but I love birds, and it's so surprising that some of them are very affectionate, very cuddly. I'm like, wow, like I didn't think that that's the case with birds, but some of them are.
Shout out to the four German Shepherds I have in this room, Indio, Junior, Sabrina, and Sasha. I love these guys. They're always in here when we're podcasting, guys, so they're phenomenal. Here's my trademark question. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
If you ever heard of the term Vietnamese boat people, I'm one of those where we had to escape out of Vietnam. It was communist government. So I was out at sea for 7 days and six nights. And so that whole, the boat was barely going anywhere, but that whole journey was a huge miracle. Most people die in that process and we didn't. And so, yeah, and I was only 11 years old at that time.
Wow. What it, geez, man, that is a crazy story. So this last question is brought to you by Shiana Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in this world?
My biggest impact I'd love to leave is making a difference for especially young people. Because I came here when I was so young without my parents, I lived 20 something years without my parents. So I felt like I was an orphan, which even though I was never an orphan, but because I was so young. And so I love making a difference for young people, especially when it comes to entrepreneurship, financial literacy. I love that.
I freaking love that. Those are some great answers. The lightning round is my favorite part of the show. Thank you for entertaining us on that part of the episode. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation, to my company Legacy Acquisitions, and to our sponsors, Good Egg Investment, Syndication Pro, Apartment Educators, The Family Office Club, and PitchDex.com. Go check out their offers at capitalraisershow.com. Unless you want to pay full price, then go direct to those guys. All right, man. So, Tim, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
Three ways. Number one, join our Facebook group, capitalraisingnation.com. Join our weekly virtual meetup, capitalraisingparty.com. And join our event coming up in December, on December 1st to 3rd, capitalraisingsummit.com.
So let's chat a little bit about this. This event, I would really love to go, but I am done traveling for the year. So next year, I definitely would like to check this out. What inspired you to create an event? What's going to be going on at this event?
Yeah, so we're bringing together, gosh, the country's top syndicators, capital raisers, everybody from Richard Wilson to Dan Hanford to Ben Ferris and Ben Suttles and Ferris Musa and Corey Peterson, George Abreu, like a lot of top guys in our industry. Damn. I brought them together because I wanted to learn from them. And so I'm like, I want to learn from them and I want to bring others along to learn from them. So that was the reason.
All right, cool, man. This has been a blast, dude. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser as they scale on their journey?
Focus on relationships, long-term relationships, and trust that it's all going to work out in everybody's favor. So long-term relationships.
Woo, that was fun, man. Dude, I had no idea what we were going to talk about, man. We went down some pretty cool roads. Thank you so much, Tim, for coming on the show. And I will see you at your weekly capital raising party. If you guys are not there, you guys are missing out. It is a phenomenal event. 60, 70, sometimes 80 people in the room on a weekly basis. That's absurd. So very cool, man.
For 2 hours.
Yes, do not schedule 1 hour, guys. Schedule a little bit more than that so you can go into breakout rooms. Cool, dude. All right, man. This has been really fun getting to know you, and I look forward to spending more time with you over the next few years. I'll be following your progress, man. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Ruben, for having me on the show. Thanks, everybody.